So, the last speaker for the workshop, Steve.
Moment we call the waiter. Okay, so I go up until half past four.
Sorry?
Five past four.
Yeah, that's fine.
Hi, I'm Steve Walker. I work for ARA. I work in a multidisciplinary team which contains people involved in both daylighting but probably more involved in thermal aspects of design. So I'm going to take you through a few examples that we have where we've integrated radiance somehow into things that we've been working on. Three main areas. The first one is a little reminiscent of one of the speakers earlier in that it's a design context. And we're working in particular examples in sunny climates, perhaps the Middle East, not the only part in the world, where we've used radiance and daylight considerations, but often thermal considerations are equally, if not more important, and there's a kind of an eternal opposition between the two that we have to reconcile. I'll get into some more complex examples here of sun systems, and then there's a slightly different one involving reflection clusters. So in a design context, we're often time constrained, almost always time constrained, and the money, our time, is usually a strict limitation as well. So ways in which we can work quickly and get to useful results with the available information are huge importance to us. Often these days there are big complex 3D models available, so one of the things we've been working on is trying to make the best use we can of them. We found Rhino, so a tool that we like, and the object to RAD conversion is highly robust. We're talking about 300 megabyte models there, and I think we've gone up to a gigabyte as well, and Radiance has happily worked with it. At the early stages of design, we need to take decisions quite quickly, and often an estimate that we can give an order of magnitude or perhaps plus or minus 30% will be much more high value than something much more precise that takes a week, 2 weeks, or longer to obtain. More refined design can happen later in the process, and what I won't talk much about is some of the more sophisticated thermal tools like Energy Plus, which I've mentioned a number of times. What I'm talking about is something that needs to happen much sooner in the design. So if you take an example project, this one is in the Middle East. It's a lot of different facade types. This is one of the early concepts. It's lots of different orientations. They're in closed courtyards. There's lots of different ideas about the facade types. They involve vertical louvers. There's punch facades. There's lots of different internal space usages as well. There's a library, there's office space, there's retail, there's, the list goes on. Lots and lots of different unique cases. We had a space of just a few weeks to try and figure out what the particularly external shading systems ought to be and relate that to some of the big decisions about mechanical systems. So in a workflow we've kind of evolved to deal with that. One thing that we knew we needed was a time series data, so like hourly profiles of particularly solar gains, but we also wanted to use that for daylighting as well, so we can get electric lighting energy usage estimates and all that. And then use that same sort of modeling process for getting estimates of thermal ones. So principal factors there, to echo some of the comments earlier. G value for glazing, I think I missed off the percentage of glazing, that's a key one. And then U values for glazing solid parts of the facade. Now, in a really big model, then what we found a way of dealing with it is, and it's kind of rather abstracted version here, is to take information which is coming from a large model, so this is contextual. Our building is the one in the middle of here, and then there's surrounding buildings. We're in some sort of metropolitan urban environment. Set up grids across that surface in order that we can sample outward from those and use that to generate shadow maps. to read these things, it's kind of like a stereoscopic sampath projection. Zenith in the center. And then what we're storing is a view of the world from each of those grid points. So we can use that to relate to the solar vector, the direction from which the sun is shining, and a weather record. So from that, for each point across the facade here, we can we know whether it's in direct sun, whether it's in shadow, and that information will be further used for calculating, say, diffuse values, diffuse reflected, and so on. So that's quite fast. Armed with that, and then these are processes which are kind of outside of gradients, then we can build up a profile of, this isn't energy use, but really loads in the building. So we're looking at diffuse and direct gains, and we can divide those up into, if you can read this one up here, the different colours in the bar chart are contributions from different facades as we go through. This happens to be the day for which maximum gains occur. And so there's some early in the morning, a particular facade is more exposed, and then another one later. If you view that in this profile, which is months against time of the year, then we're also interested in whether our maximum actually represents some extreme or some other more representative statistic, like a 98th percentile, for example. So all of that can happen quite quickly. The geometrical parts, particularly the shading by external buildings, become quite efficiently from radiance and something. But what we use that for at an early stage is kind of key decisions about what mechanical system we might be using. So here's one take on it. I think there's as many variations on this type of information as there are mechanical engineers. But what it's telling you is what a range of different strategies for air conditioning can deal with in terms of load. So natural ventilation is down here in the up to 25 watts per meter squared. And then if you get into these high volume air systems like VAV, then you really can deal with quite high loads. So what we'll be doing is rather not an optimization method, not a computational optimization method, but rather one where we're trying to ally some of this information with our own intuition and past experience to get to good decisions about what is likely to be the system. Now, I should say, most of you are talking about thermal loads. All of this is feeding into daylight information. It tends to be fairly simplistic at this sort of stage. We're looking at quantities of daylight rather than some of the more sophisticated examples we saw earlier. Now, some types of, I think really I'm talking about external shading here. Shading things are more amenable to being parameterized. And one example is this sort of system of parallel louver blades. Now, it's parameterized in our model to in a number of ways. We can change the spacing, tilt angle, and so on. What we can obtain from it is data like this, which is direct transmission data. So for that particular alignment, that's that direction there is where the kind of the blades are orientated. And then as you go off of that angle, then it falls off. Similarly, you can get some approximation to the diffuse transmission as well from that. Now, in the Middle East, designs like this, Mashrabiya screens, are quite popular. It's quite difficult to look at it and be intuitive about how it might perform in terms of its shading function. So there is a kind of sampling method that we've used, rather like the sampling we used for getting all the external buildings, how they shape the building, but applied to here, so distributed across the surface. And then with some post-processing, some statistics, you can obtain a direct transmission, diffuse transmission characteristic like this. The curves there are representing different azimuthal angles. That becomes a layer that we can use in some of the work I touched on them earlier as a layer in the external facade of the building. Sunny conditions present different sorts of problems. The nice, simple, fast daylight pattern method doesn't work very well because sunny skies dominance over all others. And we found cumulative sky methods are quite useful. Now, I won't dwell too long on this. I think there's quite a lot of different ways in which you can generate cumulative skies. A couple of variations on it that I found useful are to be able to generate cumulative skies with lots of suns and moons we have here to maximise the size of the disk here. So we're not talking about half degree arc of solar disk size. What we're accumulating over the sky is all the positions of the sun from obtaining it. Now, in my first attempt at this, I had all of the suns kind of organised on a sort of theta phi scheme, and they lined up on azimuthal lines, which led to some pretty obvious artifacts when it came to rendering. So a way of getting around that is to play with the coordinate systems a bit. So I kind of accumulated over a different coordinate system and then rotated it back to get it into world coordinates, which means that you get kind of nice jiggled up pattern of suns which get rid of that particular artifact. And going a little bit further, it's quite useful at times to find out what happens over a specific period of the year, so like June or April, or some period of time and season. So you have a kind of zone in the sky which represents solar radiation from that direction, from that period, which can be related to, say, electric lighting usage. Probably should press on. You can, from that, get pictures. This is actually a master plan, so what we're looking at is cumulative radiation averaged over a month at different times of the year, for summer or for winter month here, which feed into some of the master plan type issues we get into. Talking of which, microclimate, by that I mean really the spaces outside of buildings, so particularly in some place, well, could be anywhere, but in places like the Middle East, the external spaces tend to be underused because it's often a pretty extreme, uncomfortable climate. And what this whole microclimate design approach is about is how you can best make use of that space. What design decisions can we take which can improve that? So that might include, at a master plan stage, spacings between buildings, the signs, massing, density and so on, but also things that we can add like shading externally, planting exposed bodies of water. Now to do that, what we're really needing to know about is human thermal comfort, and that needs quite a bit of knowledge about things like thermal radiation, surface temperatures and so on. Now we've found some ways, and I'm really talking about first order methods here, which radars can be pretty useful in contributing to that. So we take a kind of canyon type situation, so building, and some person in the middle. Then if you're really trying to work out the comfort conditions here, you need to know air temperature. Well, we can get that from various means. The first approximation is what's in a weather file. We do need to know what surface temperatures are around, so there would be the ground, but also building surfaces. Now, if you take some simplifying assumptions, like these building surfaces are fairly lightweight, responsive, and insulated from their interior, then it's possible to make an estimate of the solar air temperature, which is to say, if it's in sun, how much it will increase in temperature and re-radiate in longer wavelengths, which contributes to something called the mean radiant temperature. Now, the method that we're using, well, actually, is this term here for the radius a bit here. The F is representing a form factor, and that can be fairly readily calculated from radiance. So if we're taking a point in the building, then what we're trying to find are the form factor values to a building or to the sky. The sky has a temperature, and that can be reasonably well predicted with some well-known models which involve air temperature, humidity, tidal depth, and so on. They start off as non-linear because it's Stefan Boltzmann, it's 2 to the 4, but linearized, which is what this radiant heat transfer coefficient here is, then we can simplify the calculation considerably and run this for lots of points over a large master plan track space. So for this point P here, we would have tens of thousands or more distributed over a large site. And we're applying these things. The alpha is an absorptivity, 1 minus emissivity in some ways of looking at it. Q is the rate incident solar, and drag of T, air temperature. Okay, for the solar air temperature, then what we have to do is sample out from where you stand, and we use the Tregenza type distribution. Then we just extracted a bit of rather rubbish visualization. Didn't get a nice looking way of visualizing that data straight off. But what we're trying to pick up is there's a part of the building in the bright sun here, it's hotter, and that translates into higher temperatures here, which is why it's been plotted. If you extend that over a large plan like that, master plan, then you can obtain mean radiant temperatures over the whole thing. Another ingredient that we need to put into it is air velocity, and that is not easy to predict in an urban environment. So what we used is a fairly elaborate, complex CFD model. It's transient, it uses large energy simulation, there's a synthetic atmospheric boundary layer. Anyway, what it gets us is values for wind speed ratios all over our site. And that can in turn, this actually is just a snapshot from a time-varying simulation that we had. We can calculate things like SET. SET is a standard effective temperature measure. It's a fairly sophisticated measure of human comfort. It takes into account air temperature, humidity, mean radiant temperature, airspeed. What we can use it to do is to inform decisions which are improving, hopefully, conditions on the site. So again, I'm not sure if this is the same master plan model or perhaps. We have these street canyon situations, which is where we've done our calculations. The darker red is where it's a canyon. Red is bad. On our scale here, it means you're hot, sweating, perspiring profusely, and it's really unpleasant. What we really want to get to is these more comfortable bands down here, under 30 degrees on the scale, the blue or the green. So...
Is that meant to correspond to degrees Celsius, or is it just a coincidence that it's...
It's... acetate. It is in... It's graded in degrees Celsius, but it's not what you measure from a thermometer.
Right, I understand that. So it's like effective temperature.
Yes, it's effective temperature in a standard environment, in fact. So if you make it isothermal and set some other parameters, then you get a standard effective temperature that you can calculate in a lot of different situations.
Okay,
impact of shading. So what we can quantify more readily is what difference putting these sorts of devices out into the street can make. It certainly improves things. We get less red in it. If we add other features as well, like planting bodies of water and so on, then combined with some of these other thermal measures that we've been talking about, then we get significant improvement. The visual environment comes more readily. That's more easily modeled in radiant, so I didn't actually include a slide on that. Okay, last subject, just about on time. It's been mentioned by one or two others earlier here today, generally the workshop, that swooping, curved, freeform facades are getting more and more common. And either in glass or other shiny materials, it's becoming not common but not infrequent to see problems with reflected heat from focusing on that type of facade happening. There's a number of Gehry buildings which are notorious. The Walt Disney Concert Hall, and I think there's a new one. I found this on the web. It looks to me like it's been photoshopped. It's a bit too reminiscent of 9/11 and, you know, like the death rate from across
the
air.
The Gehry Tower?
Yeah, it is. Gehry
Tower. I wrote a problem, Gehry's. I think we've seen a few of his projects. I lied to put it.
Well, I read the reports, and apparently it set fire to one plastic chair, so I think this is exaggerated. Anyway, what I was looking for in another project, which I really can't tell you the name of or where it is, but it's still current, is a method by which we could make some useful predictions and model that sort of reflection closely. Now, I've since learned, Greg pointed out to me and showed an example, you can do this sort of analysis through passive contract. I confess, I don't know how to do that yet. So I figured out another way of doing it. What we're doing is basically using an idealized model. We'll take the facade model that we have and make it perfectly specular, and then we effectively forward ray trace on that. So we take a position from which the sun, well, direction from which the sun will shine, send rays onto the facade, collect where they land on the target surface, and then perform some post-processing to make a histogram, basically. So more rays landing in a particular zone means more intensity. Basically, what we're trying to find is a magnification factor. The way that that's implemented, this is a bit of a drawing slide. The first bit of it is to start quite distant from the building. The view file here is actually a parallel view, and the view rays command here is quite a convenient way of setting a density of rays. So the parallel view combined with these parameters here give us a density, and what we're looking for later on is how that density compares with what lands on the target surface. Now, the kind of the trick to it here is using the T option to minus O in R-trace. What it means is that exposed is the ray tree, and I've set particular material types that we're looking for. So in the first pass, we're trying to start distant from the building and then filter out the ones which actually reach the facade so that we're not counting rays that would hit a building in between the sun and the facade. The second pass uses that and bounces off of the specular facade, and then we can collect basically the ones that land on the target. So that's this grep filter down here. The orc ones are basically changing the number of columns in the field. So the first one has got OOD, which is six fields, and then the end is a further one. So six fields here drops the last one. And then for the output that we're looking for is simply the coordinate of the point that lands on a target surface. So if you make a histogram of that, it might look something like that. You're collecting over some rectangular bin in space. The process which actually I considered PMAP with, for reasons of my own confidence in the process, decided I'd go with this, does mean that we can do some visualization of rays as well, which can be helpful if you're trying to figure out where a particular caustic has originated. Now, if you take a particular example...
Can you back that up for a sec?
Yep.
Is the place where all those rays cross about 6 feet off the ground?
Yeah, it is.
Head height. Just curious.
In this example, we found that this building is intended to be polished stainless steel mirror finish. It swings around, it turns a corner, but there are evil concave parts to it. Now, they're obvious to probably anyone in the room here, but they're going to be problematical. Our task is to try and figure out a way of communicating how that would be problematical, and then work with them as to ways in which they, short of sandblasting it, which we didn't want to do, ways in which we could get around that. So there's a number of this sort of incidents around the building. So what I've given here is a kind of time sequence of one of those particular instances. So what I found was pretty important for this was to get the data into... Get the data into its 3D context. So I've actually, it was a pain to do it, but written out the data into VTK format so that we could get neighbouring buildings and so on in its context and read where these caustics are forming. So if we start cycling through the day. The scale, actually, 100 represents 1 to 1, so no magnification. 200 represents a factor of 2. Quite sensitive to the shape of the facade, and it's not really intuitive at all as to the nature of the cost it performs. So as we, these are half-hour intervals, we see this quite pronounced one forming here. Now it's way up the scale. I looked at the data around here. There's some parts of here up to a magnification factor of 15. So 15 kilowatts per meter squared landing on some parts of this. So that's quite warm and toasting, I think, if you experience it. Probably they should do something about it. Okay, so you can see this time sequence is going on from that in a design contest. We did the obvious thing of trying to trace back from, say, this area where strong caustics are forming to find where they came from. And then rather predictably, we found that all of the surface was contributing to it. So it really didn't say much about one part's better or worse. So the conversation then has moved on to radically changing its shape. Quite a difficult problem. Okay, so some things I've noticed about that. It's pretty fast. You can, because we don't actually have any light sources in the scene at all, that computation is fast. It's probably the slowest bit is post-processing it and getting it into VTK format. I didn't actually implement a dot product for the incident radiation with the surface normal. You could do that, but really we decided that it would be sufficient to find a magnification factor. I made a note about where I said something about reversing the process. It didn't actually turn out to be that informative. Then, in terms of what does it do in other areas that we might not have put a target surface, because there is some intervention by us in deciding, well, that looks like the right place to put a target surface. So we tried volume rendering, which does generate a lot of data, but really didn't find it all that easy to interpret. So this is a snapshot of this volume rendered in VTK. You can kind of read more intense spaces. We tried putting a slice in with contours. It's pretty hard to work with, and basically I gave up on it. There may be some more sophisticated means of volume rendering, but we ran out of time, basically. I think that covers everything I was going to rush through, so I think I've probably gone pretty quickly. But that's it. Any questions?
Just thinking generally about this problem with concave specular surfaces, one approach, a mitigating approach you could take is the sort of the inverse of a Fresnel reflector, set up little facets to all face in one plane. So you take the curved global shape and then you turn it into locally flat. So worst case, you get a magnification of 2. I mean, it changes the appearance entirely, so maybe the architect wouldn't be interested in that. And it might introduce manufacturing issues, but it would get around. You'd still be able to maintain the global shape without having to change the surface.
Yeah, one could do that at a fairly small scale, so at least from a distance, it's not having such an impact. One of the reasons I didn't use PMAP was because I wanted to be pretty confident about what I'm saying. These are quite expensive decisions to take on the design here. Some of it's been built, and it's costing a lot of money to change it. So one needs to be pretty confident that what you say is going to work is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
We did have access to a prototype, which did give us a bit more confidence. We could compare our model terms with a real thing. Sandblasting. Probably be the surefire way.
Well, sandblasting, if you did enough of it, it would diffuse the problem. But if you just had a light sandblasting, you'd still get a concentration. I don't know how much.
Yeah, if there's something in between purely diffused, like paper-like surface,
mm-hmm.
hard to deal with that.
Right, yeah.
And certainly this method wouldn't cope with that either.
Right. questions?
With the thermal comfort calculation, did you use the UTCI tool?
Yes, sir.
Universal Thermal Comfort Index by Fiona. We found that particularly in hot, humid climates, so that's a very good model for kind of how to thermal comfort, and that also includes metabolic rate and thermal value as well.
Yeah, there are a number of quite similar metrics. PET is another one. The reason we're using SET is because it doesn't have some of the other statistical thermal sensation aspects connected to it. So that's to say it doesn't give you a percentage dissatisfied. What we're looking at is specific values as well, skin temperature and measures of that nature as well. So whilst it's useful to talk in global terms about SET and putting into these thermal sensation bands, actually the thing that we were judging it more by were some of the other more detailed things behind the calculation. And I think you'll probably find that the same sorts of components. SET is a two-way model, so it has a core temperature and skin temperature. And the skin temperature part of it is most complex because you've got evaporation and all sorts of other things going on. Those components will be in most of those types of measure. The difference tends to be in the statistical bit which is added onto it. So that particular one I'm not familiar with, but we looked at a few. Thank you.
When you want to take the solar information into account, the SET and the humidity?
Yes, those are inputs you have to give to it. So you need to know the dry bulb air temperature. You need to know humidity as a relative humidity, mean radiant temperature, surface temperatures all around you, and airspeed. That gets quite difficult to calculate if you've got things. Screens in particular, is it screening the sun? What temperature is that at? You know, screening you from the sun, so that's not raising the radiant temperature, but it's getting hot itself and re-radiating. And then convection plays a part as well as to its final temperature.
So.
Copy,
thank you very much.
Thanks.